going to be around till Friday. So I don't think I need to introduce Santiago for this audience. So let him start telling us about spin and pair dancing with wavelengths.
Thanks, Luis. It's always wonderful to come back to PI. So I know that many of you, at least the local people at PI, work on topological faces. The last few times that I've talked about my work at PI, it's also been about topological faces. Now, most of you know that condensed matter divided into soft and hard matter, H bar equals zero and H bar not equal to zero. So topological faces and quantum condensed matter should be thought of as H bar equals infinity, because everything is gapped and you're dealing with quantum ground state. So to atone for the sin of working at H bar equals infinity, I'm going to tell you about a project which is H bar equals zero. So you balance it and hopefully reach H bar equals one. Anyway, that's my excuse for talking about this topic. I'll define these terms as I go along. My collaborator is a former student, David Ross, who's now at Caltech as a postdoc. Been working on this for a while, so it started when he was still a student. I want to thank Leon Balance, Thierry Jamarki, and David Hughes for encouragement as we went along in this topic. So spin density waves are very, very common in solids, all kinds of systems. The younger people in the audience will know that tube plates have spin density waves, nictides have spin density waves, and so on. There are older examples going back to chromium. Elemental chromium is a spin density wave. So the question that I'll question that I'll address in this talk is the effect of impurities on incommensurate density wave order, focusing on spin density waves. And the punchline is that I'll argue that if you have weak non-magnetic disorder, then it results in a new phase, which I'll call a spin density wave glass, which is distinct from the more conventional Heisenberg spin glass that also exists as a possible phase in this kind of system. Okay? And related questions arise in thinking about impurity effects on a completely different state of matter, which I'll explain as we go along. It's called the pair density wave. And this arises in the work of Erisberg and collaborators, Eduardo Frodkin, Steve Givelson, and other people that I'll mention as we go along. So first let me define the term spin density wave and pair density wave. And since we're going to discuss the effects of impurities on these states, we first have to know what these states are, what their order parameters are, and it'll be important to understand what the structure of the topological defects are in these states. And let me, for concreteness, make some simplifying assumptions. Let me consider a uniaxial spin density wave, not a spiral where the spins are doing that, but a state where the spin is just, has a fixed direction of quantization and is oscillating up and down. And I'll also assume that the density wave ordering is unidirectional in space with a direction that's chosen by the symmetry of the underlying crystal. For instance, the crystal may be orthorhombic and these spin density modulations may just go along one axis of the crystal. And finally, I'll assume, again for simplicity, to consider the simplest set problem in this class, I'll assume that the order is incommensurate with any underlying crystalline lattice. Okay. So loosely speaking, a spin density wave that satisfies these conditions, sometimes people call them a spin stripe, familiar from tube plate physics. So here's a picture of a kind of spin stripe that's common in the lanthanum-based tube plates. It's what's known as an anti-phase stripe. So the spins go up, down, and then there's the stripe. And then across this place where there's no spin, and you go to the next site where there is a spin, the spin orientation in this next site, it's as though it was the nearest neighbor of this site. It goes from down, up, down, up, down, and it's this empty site again and up again. Right? So if you just remove these empty sites, It would just look as though it's a nail ordered pattern. But if the empty sites were occupied by spins, then you know the pattern of nail ordering has shifted by, rotated by pi as you go from this section of the sample to this section. That's why it's called anti-phase. Right? So the phase of the spin density wave has shifted by pi across this type. Right? And this is actually seen, ordering of this kind is seen in the lanthanum-based tube rates. Yeah?
So that's like commensurate.
That this picture is commensurate. It's easier for me to draw a commensurate picture. But I'll be talking about incommensurate ordering. Right? Right, so it's a question of whether the some multiple of this ordering wave vector matches the lattice, you know, reciprocal vectors or not. Right. Whether after some units of this period you return to the original site. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and incommensurate order seen in the large number of materials. It's you know, including tube rates, but yeah. So typically, a spin stripe implies coexisting charge ordering, charge stripe ordering, and this is because of a simple Landau argument that goes back decades. So if you write down a free energy for the spin ordering, there's a term in the free energy which is allowed by symmetry, and that's proportional to spin squared, which is a scalar, times the charge density rho. So the spin is modulated at some wave vector q, then spin squared is modulated at wave vector 2q, and that then acts as a random field that couples to the charge density, and that will then induce a modulation of the charge density at wave vector 2q. Okay. So spin stripe ordering necessarily implies, you know, unless you're fine-tuned in some way, implies ordering charge stripe ordering, charge order at wave vector, which is twice the wave vector of spin ordering. Okay. And you can see that in this picture, the charge ordering occurs in here, right? And the wavelength of charge ordering is this much, where the wavelength of spin ordering is that guy, right? Yeah. Sorry? Rho is the charge density, absolutely, yeah. So spin stripe ordering typically implies charge stripe ordering through this Landau argument, but the reverse is not true. So if there's charge stripe ordering, then that does not imply spin stripe ordering. So if rho is modulated at 2q, then you know there's a term which is proportional to spin squared, which is modulated at 2q, but that doesn't necessarily drive spin ordering at wave vector q. Okay. So let's write down an order parameter for the spin density wave. So the spin is modulated at wave vector q, so there'll be some Fourier component at wave vector q, which in general will be a complex vector, a complex three-component vector, because the spin is a three-component vector. But because it's a Fourier transform, at the Fourier component at some wave vector q, it will in general be complex. But the assumption that it's not spiral ordering, but rather collinear ordering, implies that this complex wave, complex number, this complex Fourier component can be written as a phase times a real vector. Okay? And the physical meaning of this phase is that it's the displacement of the stripe. So if I move these stripes a little bit, then this theta s is precisely the stripe displacement. Okay, and n can be understood as the local nail vector. Okay, and the charge density wave order parameter is e to the 2i theta s. It doesn't know anything about n. So it's the square of the spin density wave order parameter. So it's e to the 2i theta s times n squared. But n squared is, you know, you might as well take that to be one. For instance, think in terms of a hard spin. If n is just the orientation of the spin, then the CDW order parameter essentially is given by e to the 2i theta s. Okay. So the convenient formal way to think about this So the spin density wave order parameter is e to the I theta s times this real vector n, and the CDW order parameter is e to the 2 I theta s. So both these order parameters are composites. The way we've written this, they're composites of two different fields. So let me introduce a field B as e to the I theta s, and the other field is n. So clearly, the spin density wave order parameter is a product of B and n. Well, the CDW order parameter is just B squared, right? So both the physical order parameters are composites of these two, built out of these two fields, B and n, okay? So this formulation, if we chose to formulate this problem in terms of B and n, that formulation has a Z2 gauge redundancy, because locally, I can change the sign of B and n without changing the physical order parameter, okay? So this, like a slave particle description that's familiar, say, from the quantum spin liquids and things of that sort. But I should emphasize that throughout this talk, there'll be no fractionization or any such thing. But the slave formulation will be useful nevertheless. So throughout this talk, I am at H bar equals zero. And for most of the talk, it'll also be at temperature equals zero. And hopefully the content is not zero, okay? All right. So closely related orders, this paired density wave, which I mentioned before, it's a superconductor. And what it is it's a specific case of Cooper pairing at non-zero momentum, as in the classic Faraday-Locke-Ovchinnikov state. So Faraday-Locke and Ovchinnikov are actually different from each other. Faraday-Locke is more like spiral order, where Ovchinnikov is the collinear type order. So the pair amplitude, delta of x, is not at zero momentum, as in usual BCS, the usual superconductor, but rather the pair amplitude is modulated at some wave vector q. So this has many, many names in the literature. I guess the original name was the Ovchinnikov superconductor, in the recent literature, it's, for various reasons, people have chosen to distinguish it and call it the paired density wave superconductor. Sometimes it's called the striped superconductor or Tamperian superconductor, depending on its origins. But this state has made an appearance in the recent literature in solid state physics because of an interesting proposal that it may actually be realized in lanthanum barium copper oxide, one member of one of the cuprate families. So at a particular doping level, the group at Stanford proposed that this sort of modulated superconductor may occur and use that to suggest an explanation of various experiments that were done in this material at that doping level. So formally, the paired density wave ordering is conceptually very, very similar to spin density wave ordering, particularly if you have a spin density wave, which is just where the spin is just an XY spin, right? In one case, the spin, the XY spin is modulated in space. In the other case, some other XY order parameter, namely the Cooper pair order parameter, is modulated in space, okay? There is a subtle difference between the paired density wave and an XY type spin density wave, which has to do with the action of time reversal symmetry. Okay? So the spin density wave obviously breaks time reversal, but a paired density wave, this kind of state, doesn't break time reversal. Something happened. Being recorded. No, I have to tell only correct jokes. What's the deal? Where does it go? Thanks. So more formally, Spin U1 symmetry commutes with time reversal where the charge U1 doesn't. And for people who work on topological things, the symmetry group is different. One is U1 direct time reversal, the other is U1 semi-direct time reversal. Just a more formal way of saying the simple observation that the spin density wave breaks time reversal while the pair density wave doesn't. Okay. So let me next, so those are the two states that I want to think about, and those are the order parameters. Next, I want to think about topological defects in the spin density wave phases. A class of defects will be important for what I say, which are dislocations in the CDW order. So really, I'm going to draw pictures in two dimensions, but really I want to think both about two and three dimensions. It's, in 3D, you must imagine that these stripes are surfaces, two-dimensional surfaces that are coming out of the plane of the board. So there's this class of dislocation, which is the elementary dislocation in the CDW order, where a stripe just ends somewhere. Right? Now, since there's this anti-phase condition on the spin order around the stripe, the single dislocation, the spin doesn't know what to do. Right? It's frustrated. The spin order is frustrated around the strength one dislocation. In contrast, I could have a strength two dislocation, where something like this, and then the spin order is perfectly happy. Right? There's no problem with defining the global spin orientation anywhere in this picture. Okay. So the strength one dislocation is necessarily accompanied by a declination where the n vector rotates by pi. Right? So the n vector has to rotate by pi. So an alternate way of describing that is that the single dislocation is bound to a Z2 gauge vortex in this redundant description in terms of B and N. Okay. So the question that's a concern in this talk is the fate of incommensurate spin density waves to non-magnetic disorder. Okay. And the first observation is that such non-magnetic impurities, couple linearly to the CDW order parameter. So there'll be a component of the random potential that couples the charge density at wave vector 2q. So it's linear coupling. With V random. So there's a random field that acts on the CDW order parameter, but there's no linear coupling to the spin density wave order parameter so long as my disorder is non-magnetic. Right? So the disorder preserves time reversal and it can't couple linearly to the SDW order parameter. Okay? So that's the nature of the disorder in this problem. So the first observation to make goes back to the 1970s. I don't know when Larkin first dreamed of this stuff. It goes back to Larkin and to Imrie and Ma, that this sort of random field coupling destroys the CDW order in all physical dimensions. And the basic physics is a competition between the random field energy and the elastic energy associated with distorting the charge density wave. Okay? So if you think about a large region of size L, In this large region, the random potential will more or less be averaged to zero, but it'll have some fluctuations about that value of zero. And the strength of the typical fluctuation for a region of size L will be L to the D over 2. And the energy that you gain in aligning over some large region, aligning yourself with the random field, with the random potential, the energy gain will be of order L to the D over 2. And this must be balanced against the elastic energy cost of distorting away from the clean system. For continuous symmetry, elastic energy scale like L to the D minus 2. And by comparing these two, you can see that the random potential always wins so long as D is less than 4 for large enough L. So the elastic energy lost by following the random potential is overwhelmed by the potential energy gain so long as D is less than 4. So that's the Larkin argument, and it tells you that in all physical dimension, with this continuous symmetry breaking, random fields will immediately destroy the long-range order, even if the strength of the random field is infinitesimal. Okay? So the CDW long-range order is lost beyond some length scale, which you can get by comparing these two things, known as the Larkin length, which depends on the elastic constant and the typical strength of the random potential in some manner. Okay, there's some finite length scale called the Larkin length. So the picture is that everything stays ordered up to that length scale, and beyond that length scale, something happens, and long-range order is lost. So that was for the CDW order. Yeah?
So does that depend on the density of the defects?
No, we'll come to defects in a minute. This argument is just a very simple argument. I mean, balancing this that potential energy gain versus the elastic energy lost. Right? So what eventually happens, the eventual fate of the system will depend on what the defects are doing. So we'll come to defects later.
Right? Is there like an assumption about the randomness in the Gaussian distribution?
No, for this argument, it doesn't really matter. Central limit will apply eventually. At this stage, you can take a Gaussian distribution, of course, but you might only use central limit theorem. Right? So now problem, where there's no linear coupling to the spin density wave part, what's the fate of the spin density wave order? So we saw that the spin density wave implies CDW, so therefore no CDW implies no SDW. So beyond this Larkin length, you can't have long-range spin density wave order. Okay. So what happens at long scales? And this, so the behavior at long scales is what I'll claim is described by the spin density wave glass. And what I want to do is to tell you what this is and describe the physics of the system at long scales, at scales beyond the Larkin length. Okay. Let me start with three dimensions and discuss the spin density wave glasses in three dimensions. So let me start with the charge density wave, the simpler problem of the pin charge density wave. So here there was an important development in the 1990s, which Michel Gingras played a huge role in with a very important numerical calculation. But the ideas go back before to J. Markey and Le Dussol, and there's some literature. So weak disorder in three dimensions. So what these papers argued was that the CDW enters an elastic glass phase where these defects, long dislocation loops, do not actually occur in the optimal ground state configuration so long as the disorder is weak. Okay. This suggested by Jean-Marc Le Dussol, and just Michel gave nice numerical evidence, proof appeared in a fairly impenetrable paper of Daniel Fisher somewhat later. Okay. So this system is described then, if there are no dislocation loops of any sort, then we can describe it by a random field XY model, but without any vortices, where we suppress the vortices by hand. So this phase, the resulting phase, is variously called either elastic glass or Bragg glass. I think the term elastic glass is a better description, because the Bragg glass term makes more specific assumptions. What happened? Sorry? There. All right. I'm going the wrong way. So in the absence of dislocations, the long distance fate of the system of the CDW component should be described by a random field XY model without vortices. And this problem was studied for many years, starting from the 1980s. And there are many, many approximate treatments of the problem, most serious of which is a very sophisticated denormalization group treatment near four dimensions, known as the function log G, was developed by Daniel Fisher in the 1980s for problems of this kind. And the result of this calculation, particularly this function log G, is that there is that this problem goes into a phase. In the absence of vortices, it goes into a phase where the XY order has power law correlations, goes into a scale invariant state where the XY order has power law correlations. So this means that the CDW order parameter, a disorder averaged, has some power law correlation with some universal critical exponent, and that critical exponent can be estimated within this function log G. That if you extrapolate from the leading order calculation, number you get is about 1. It's 1.1. So the physical picture is a delta function Bragg peaks in the system, which existed in the absence of random potential, are destroyed according to this Locke-Imrie-Mohr argument. There's no delta function Bragg peak anymore, but instead you're left with the power law Bragg peak with a universal exponent. So that's the description of this elastic glass phase. This in three dimensions. Yes. I'll talk about 2D later. I'm not going to talk about 1D. So in our problem, we're interested in this spin, in a spin density wave. So what's the fate of the spin order? Right? So I already argued that there can't be any long-range spin density wave order, right? Because there's no long-range CDW order. But there's no long dislocation loops, means that there are no frozen Z2 gauge vortices. Equivalently, this means that the spin density wave order parameter sees random bond disorder, right? Random stiff, local stiffnesses, but there's no frustration that it sees. Right? So the frustration occurs only around these dislocation loops, but since there are no dislocation loops, there's no frustration of the spin order. This means that since the spin density wave order parameter is a product of B times N, and B has power law correlations, but N itself has true long range order. Okay? So the spin density wave order, the disorder average of it, factorizes into an average over the product of these phase fields, the slight displacement, and this N vector, but the N has true long-range order, so this is just one. And so you just get the correlator of this phase field, and that decays as a power law with some exponent, but since this exponent, the leading order function log G, will give you an estimate for this exponent as 0.27. And really, this comes about because for the CDW correlator, the corresponding average involves e to the 2i theta s. So if this field theta s at this random fixed point is described by a Gaussian probability distribution, then the exponent for the spin density wave should be exactly a quarter of the exponent for the charge density wave. But we know that in general, the probability distribution for this field is not Gaussian. So in general, these two exponents will not satisfy this relation. And it's a recent 2DeForest paper within this epsilon expansion, which attempts to quantify the extent of non-Gaussianity of these probability distributions. Okay? The qualitative point is that true, the spin density wave order decays, but it decays much more slowly than the charge density wave order decays, right? And which is physically reasonable. You know, the disorder only couples quadratically to the spin density wave, right? Not linearly. So much more robust to disorder. So, but what is the meaning of this N ordering? Right? So N itself is not gauge invariant. It has this gauge redundancy. And so N itself is not observable. But we know that, so once you have N order, it implies that N squared, a quantity like this, also has long range order. And this is a spin quadrupole moment. So this system, therefore, has spin nematic order. What it means is that you have spontaneous spin anisotropy without long-range spin density wave order. So similar observations were made actually long time ago by Jan Zanin with respect to thermal or quantum melting of spin stripes. But here, with disorder, we see that in three dimensions, the generic fate of a linearly polarized spin density wave is to form a spin nematic state with no long-range spin density wave order. So the physical picture is actually very, very simple. What happens is that these spin stripes, so this is a photograph of what the spin configuration does. So this, everything is static in this picture. It's not a snapshot. This is what the equilibrium configuration looks like. So these stripes distort, but there are no dislocations, so they never end, okay? And the spins are frozen, but the phase of the spin density wave is randomly disordered, and the spins clearly retain a common axis along which they point up or down. Right? So that's the meaning of spin nematic long-range order. So in this picture, you have to choose an axis of quantization along with the spins point either up or down, right? Okay. So it's a uniaxial spin glass. It actually also has spin glass order. The spins are frozen, means that there's an Edwards-Anderson spin glass order parameter. If you sit at any given site and look at the average value of the spin at that site, it's non-zero, but this value changes between different sites. Right? So it's a spin glass, but it's a uniaxial spin glass that arises in a Heisenberg spin system through spontaneous breaking of spin symmetry. So the easy axis of this emergent uniaxial spin glass is determined by spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this state is clearly distinct from the conventional Heisenberg spin glass, where the spins point in every possible direction randomly. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the charge decay is a power law, but the power is much faster than for the spin, which makes physical sense. Yeah, exactly. So, so let me contrast this spin density wave glass phase with the standard Heisenberg spin glass. So one difference is something I've already talked about. There are power law correlations of spin density wave order coexisting with the spin glass order parameter. Okay. And the second difference is what Sinsek just asked. The spontaneous spin anisotropy, the system picks a direction of quantization for the spins to orient themselves in. So associated with that, there'll be Goldstone modes. They'll be propagating gapless pneumatic director waves where the spin, this axis of quantization fluctuates slowly in the sample. So this should be contrasted with the Heisenberg spin glass, where this, at least theoretically, there's supposed to be spin wave modes associated with distortion or the spin configuration, discussed by Halperin and Saslow, you know, maybe three decades back, something like that. But they're never seen in any real spin glass, any real Heisenberg spin glass. They're always damped, seem to be damped by small structural rearrangements of the spin orient. Of the spin orientation pattern. And so, you know, this Halperin-Saslow spin wave modes probably don't really exist in any real Heisenberg spin glass. In contrast, in this state, these Goldstone modes of the spin pneumatic order should be gapless propagating states without any damping from stripe distortions. Oh, the experimental evidence is that if you measure the specific heat, it's linear in T instead of T cubed. Right? And you study any kind of dynamics, no one ever sees propagating spin waves. Right? And the understanding is that this linear T heat capacity is coming from two-level systems, yeah. And that they are strongly damping. So the hydrodynamic theory never applies. Right? There's droplet fluctuations which dominate the spin wave.
The dominant is specific heat, but that doesn't mean the spin waves won't exist. I mean, at long wavelengths, the spin waves should just go right through these two-level systems.
Yeah, it's a question of what the probability distribution of these two-level systems is down to low energy. Okay. That's what I'm told by spin glass experts. And this different magnetic field behavior between the Heisenberg spin glass and this state. So here, what will happen is that if you apply a magnetic field, the director will simply orient itself perpendicular to the field, and the spins will cant a little bit, just like an antiferromagnet. So it's instructive to think about what happens if you have a weak spin anisotropy, which is always there in any real material. So a weak intrinsic anisotropy will spin the director along some axis. For instance, there may be an easy axis. So if I apply a magnetic field along such an easy axis, then there will be a field scale, BP, below which the magnetization process will be glassy, because the only way the system can accommodate the magnetization that's induced by the field is for the stripes to reorganize, right? The stripe configuration has to change to accommodate the magnetization. Well, once my field exceeds some critical strength BP, the director will be free to depin from the easy axis, and then it'll just do this, and all the glassy effects will disappear. Right? So the field scale for glassy effects to disappear will be set by the weak anisotropy and not by the exchange constant J. Right? In contrast, in the Heisenberg spin glass, if your field exceeds J, only then does the system look non-glassy. Right? The dynamics is slow if the field is smaller than the scale set by J. Okay, so this is the main story in three dimensions. But I want to emphasize that, you know, this problem is very, very generic, right? Spin density waves exist all over the place. They're often linearly polarized. You know, spirals are much harder to come by. And real materials always have disorder, right? And typically non-magnetic disorder. So it should be relevant to all three-dimensional spin density waves, including, for instance, the classic spin density wave, elemental chromium. Chromium probably is extremely clean or can be made extremely clean, but for many years now, people have been studying what happens when you alloy chromium with other transition metals like vanadium or something. So in all these kinds of experiments, this must be what's going on. Right? The disorder is weak. These are clean systems. And weak disorder, what's the fate of the spin density wave? This is the fate. And so the spin density wave system probably provides a new opportunity to probe the physics of the Bragg glass in experiments. So the Bragg glass phase was originally discussed in the context of vortex matter, and some experiments, which look very suggestive as evidence for this kind of physics. But it's good to have a new system where you can probe perhaps other aspects of the physics, and through neutron diffraction in a spin density wave system, one can probably study this much better now. So finally, it's sort of amusing that even the classic spin glasses, which more or less started the spin glass field, for instance, things like copper manganese, it turns out if you look at them with neutron diffraction, they actually show strong spin, short range spin density wave order. So this is from a paper from the 90s. And in the textbook model of a spin glass, the spins are completely disordered, and if you do neutron diffraction, the spin structure factor should be Q independent, flat. But here, you see a strong short range spin density wave peak. This is just its mirror image and a near disk local lattice vector. And there's this peak, which is clearly visible, right? So the picture for the classic spin density wave, classic spin glasses, is not quite the textbook thing of everything pointing every which way, but rather, it's more like it's spin density waves on some length scale, which is determined by the width of this peak. And then these spin density waves fit together in some way as you go through the sample. And the microscopic mechanism seems to be that it's spinning of spin density wave fluctuations around manganese in copper that spin around manganese impurities. Okay? Quite different from the more standard pictures that one has, say, in terms of plus minus J spin glass model, or even the RKKY model, random RKKY interactions for spin glass. So the spin density wave glass physics may be the relevant starting point to describe real metallic spin glasses, right? Rather than the most standard theoretical models. Okay, so let me now turn to the case of two dimensions, which is much, much more intricate. The 3D case is more or less straightforward. The 2D case is much more delicate, and I want to talk about both spin density wave and pair density wave glasses in two dimensions. Right? In 3D, there's no proposal for this kind of pair density wave phase in any material, but in 2D, in the cuprate context, there is a specific proposal, so might as well discuss both. 1D, I don't know, I haven't, 1D, everything is just disorder. There's nothing, there's no life left in the problem in 1D, as far as I can tell. All right, besides, I'm talking about continuous symmetry. There's no broken symmetry in 1D, so yeah. I mean, unless you take the artificial limit of a purely classical model at zero temperature. Okay. So weak disorder in two dimensions, to this kind of state. Again, the Locke and Moore arguments will tell you that this accompanying CDW is disordered beyond the finite length scale, the Locke length. So the question is, what's the fate of dislocations? So here, one should recognize that single and double dislocations are possibly different because they are different structure. This is accompanied by this destination of the n vector, while this isn't. Okay. So there's two competing effects in discussing a problem of this kind. So the dislocations, of course, induce, you know, there's a texture of the order parameter because of which a dislocation costs elastic energy. This should be balanced against the fact that when you have a random field, the field, you know, the random field may, in some regions of the sample, want to have a vortex. Right? The field may rotate around in such a way that it favors a vortex. Okay? This means that the dislocations will see a random potential that they move in. And this potential, in general, will be correlated. It will have a complicated probability distribution. And what we have to do to address the question of whether dislocation is induced or not is to balance the elastic energy cost of introducing a dislocation with the optimal potential energy gain. You know, whether you can find, when you find the minimum of this potential and try to put a vortex there, right, you gain enough energy to overcome the elastic energy cost that you have to pay. Right? Now, since elastic energy plays a crucial role, we know that the single and double dislocations will cost different elastic energies. For the single dislocation, both cost log L energies, two dimensions. There are, defects in XY type models cost log L. But there's different combination of elastic constants. The CDW distortion, twists both the CDW phase and introduces this spin destination. So its energy cost depends on both the elastic constant for CDW and for spin distortions. In contrast, the double dislocation only costs picks up energy cost from the CDW stiffness, right? And it's a factor of four because it's a double dislocation. Okay. So let me start by quoting some results, which I'll give you some understanding of later, for the fate of double dislocations. So this is the same analysis as for the ordinary pinned CDW. If I didn't have any spin density, we just talk about a pinned CDW. It goes back to these papers from the late 90s. So at long length scales, much bigger than the Locke length, the average elastic energy cost still goes like log L for these double dislocations, with some elastic constant that generically denoted K. But it turns out, and that's what these papers argued, that the optimal potential energy gain for isolated dislocations goes like log L to the 3/2. Okay? Now, at long length scales, that means that this potential energy gain overwhelms this elastic energy cost. And so you always favor nucleating these strength 2 dislocations at long length scales. Okay? So this argument, it's a plausible argument. It's not rigorous. But it was supported by numerics in that first paper, Jing, Leith, and Fisher, which very nicely fit this log L to the 3/2 law. But there's a plausible argument, which I'll describe later, for why this may be true. No, right now I'm just I'm ignoring the single dislocations completely. Just asking about double dislocations. It's a case. This K is KC plus KS. Now, what this means is that you always destroy the elastic glass phase in two dimensions. And that's basically the conclusion of these papers. So, and what you end up with is exponential decay of charge density wave, and hence, since once the CDW decays exponentially, the spin density wave will also decay exponentially. And in our problem, this implies exponential decay of spin density wave correlations at long scales. If the disorder is weak, one can argue that there's a long separation, there's a parametrically long separation between the Locke length and the scale at which unbound dislocations occur, it turns out it's log n length times exponential of the square root of some constant times log of the log n length. That's some number. Okay, so the more subtle question, just actually quite delicate, is the fate of single dislocations. In particular, we can ask the question, are single dislocations necessarily generated at weak disorder? Because they are different elastic cost, one might have thought, one might expect that there may be some regimes in which they are less likely than the double dislocations. So if the single dislocations are absent, then this long-range spin pneumatic order survives even in the 2D spin density wave glass, even though there's only exponentially decaying correlations. And the physical picture will be something like this. You allow for these double dislocations, but you don't allow for single dislocations. And so the spin ordering quantization axis is well defined globally. So I phrased everything so far in the language of spin density waves, but now let me rephrase it in the language of pair density waves. It turns out that it becomes a really, really important question once you apply it to the pair density wave. So this translation is essentially done by Achterberg and Tsunetsugu and with Berg et al. A few years back. So as I said, the spin density wave and pair density wave are very, very similar conceptually. So spin pneumatic order means that the spin squared has long range order. So in the pair density wave context, it means that there's a charge 4 superconductor, superconducting order parameter that has uniform order. So the charge 2 order parameter is modulated in space, but charge 4 has uniform order. Okay. And this fact that the strength 1 CdW dislocation is bound to a pi declination of the spin in the pair density wave context, these arrows are simply the phase of the superconducting order parameter. So this is a half vortex of the superconducting order parameter where it winds by pi instead of 2 pi, that the Cooper pair phase winds by pi. This means that the analog of this phenomenon in the PDW context is that the single dislocations are tied to HC over 4E flux quanta of, you know, physical flux quanta. Right? There's a half quantum vortex that's associated with these single dislocations. So now you can see why the question we're posing is particularly interesting and important in the pair density wave. So, you know, you have a two-dimensional pair density wave with weak non-magnetic disorder, with weak disorder of some kind, which is always there in real life. So if this weak disorder necessarily generates strength one dislocations, then that means that you necessarily have, near where these dislocations are, you have half quantum vortices of either sign. You know, some place it may be plus HC over 4E, other place minus HC over 4E. So this is very, very dramatic consequence of the proposed pair density wave state. Now, this means that with weak disorder, system will spontaneously break time reversal, right, locally, but with opposite signs in different regions of the sample. And it's something that you can detect through, say, a scanning squid experiment, do a local probe of magnetic fields in the sample, and you should see this, right? So if lanthanum barium copper oxide is really in this phase, and it's, of course, disordered, then, you know, this Catherine Moeller or one of these other people who do scanning squid experiments should pick this up, okay? So that's why it's important to understand whether this happens, if it happens, when it happens, things of that sort. Yeah? No, it's not. It's not at all related. Yeah, so that's a very different story that has, you know, gauge fields and so on. This is a lot simpler than that. This is all essentially classical physics. Yeah?
So how is the, obviously it was a three-dimensional material.
Right.
Actually, we've got multiple planes, so how would this propagate?
Yes. No, it'll probe the net field coming out of the sample.
Yeah, right.
So these guys, they'll have to find a partner in the next layer. And you know, LBCO is not that anisotropic. I actually heard there is. So if you go to very, very low temperatures in the superconducting state where the layers get coupled together, part of the reason for proposal of this PDW, so in experiments, there was this layer decoupling phenomenon. But at low temperature, there's a, the layers do get coupled together. So you go to low temperature, and then you ask each such guy has to find a partner vortex, you know, find a defect somewhere else, and yeah, do that. Right? So whether or not the scanning squid can cleanly pick out this half, you know, if the density of these vortices is too high, you'll just see random currents. Right? But you should see something. Right? You should see a field. Right, in a scanning, a spontaneous field in a scanning squid experiment. Right? So this question is important. So the claim that I want to make and try to give you some inkling of why that's true is that the strength one dislocations are not necessarily generated at long scales. This is unlike the CDW, the plain CDW problem, and the answer depends on the bare elastic constants. So if the superconducting or spin, depending on which problem you're interested in, if that elastic constant is much bigger than the CDW stiffness, then you don't use single dislocations, only double dislocations proliferate. Okay? In the spin context, this means that spin pneumatic order persists in the 2D SDW glass, while in the superconducting context, it means that it preserves time reversal symmetry at weak disorder. Right? So the schematic phase diagram is a function of the strength of the random potential and the ratio of the CDW and this primary order parameter stiffnesses, so something like this. The disorder is strong enough, you'll always get single dislocations, but at weak disorder, the answer depends. Right? Let me give you some understanding of where all this comes from. So the way to discuss the energetics of the dislocation, at least the simple-minded way, is to first start with an elastic model and then, you know, impose dislocations and calculate the energies. Right? So let me illustrate this in the example of the pair density wave. So here, there's two different phase fields. One is the superconducting phase, the other is the CDW phase. And the superconducting phase has some stiffness and there's some gradient squared energy. And the CDW phase also has some stiffness. And in the absence of disorder, just has a gradient squared energy. But in the presence of disorder, there can be a random phase shift of this gradient in the form of some vector eta, which even if it's not there microscopically, will be induced by the random field that's trying to pin the phase of the CDW, okay? So this is a random field where alpha of x is uniform, for instance, in 0 to 2 pi, and this vector eta we can take to be delta function correlated with some strength sigma, okay? So the meaning of this vector eta in general is that, as we'll see, is that it acts as a random force on the vortices. Okay, of the theta c order parameter. So this elastic model in this PDW context, the theta s part basically doesn't know about the theta c part. They are decoupled from each other. So we can just think about this part of the Hamiltonian separately. And that's actually a well-studied model. It goes back to, it's a model that was studied by Cardi and Oslund in the 1980s. And there's a large, 20-year-old literature on this model. So it's a 2D XY model without vortices in a random field. So the simplest way to study this model, which sort of captures the physics even away from the regime where it's valid, is to do a perturbative denormalization group treatment of the random field, which is valid so long as your temperature is not too low. So it turns out that the random field becomes relevant below some temperature. So in the absence of the random field, in the absence of any randomness, I'm in two dimensions. And so this field has e to the I theta c has power law correlations. Right? And then this random field, at high temperature, the random field will be irrelevant in this power law correlated phase. But as I decrease the temperature, the scaling dimension of this random field will change, and at some point it will become relevant. That defines a glass transition temperature. So near that glass transition temperature, you can do a perturbative denormalization group treatment, and the stiffness doesn't flow. It turns out that's true for very general reasons. But the variance, so the random field, it's relevant below some Kc, but it has this kind of flow where just when it becomes relevant, the flow away from the g equals zero fixed point is balanced by a negative g squared term, so it flows to some fixed point value of order this small quantity, this epsilon. But this eta correlator defined here, this object has an OG flow where it just flows away to strong coupling and goes off to infinity. Now it turns out that despite, due to some very general symmetry reason, despite this one coupling constant flowing off to infinity, it doesn't feed back into the flow of the other coupling constants. And so the problem more or less has a fixed point. It's a fixed point characterized by one running coupling constant, and that running coupling constant doesn't feed back into the other OG flows. So based on this behavior, there's a conjectured picture for the long scale behavior of this model based on these OG equations. And the idea is that G flows to a fixed point value, which is small when this number is small, when it just becomes relevant. Right? But sigma is going off to infinity as proportional to log L. It turns out the coefficient is a universal number, even though these quantities A and G, them, B themselves are non-universal. Since sigma is becoming large, the proposal is that the long-scale behavior of this model is described by a model where we completely ignore the G and just keep this random eta with this running correlator. That's a plausible assumption. It's not rigorous, but it's plausible. Okay. So now we can address the energy cost of these dislocations using a simpler problem where we don't have a random field, but we just have this random phase shift, but with the special feature that the correlator of the variance of this random phase shift runs as a function of scale. So this problem, without this feature that the sigma, the variance of this guy runs with scale, was analyzed in a very nice paper 20 years back by Natterman and collaborators. Actually, Subir told me about this paper in grad school. It turns out it had unseated decade-old literature on this problem, which claimed this re-entrance. You may remember that thing. Anyway, so the analysis is actually quite simple. If you take, so this eta acts like a random, eta couples to gradient of phase. Gradient of phase is like the current. So eta is like a random force on the vortices. Since eta couples to current, and currents tend to induce force on vortices. Since eta is like a random force on the vortex, equivalently, if you wrote eta as a gradient of something, that something acts like a random potential for the vortices, okay? So in a region of size L, these dislocations see a random potential whose variance grows logarithmically in L. Right? Since a random force has short-range correlations, random potential has logarithmic correlations. So we can make a simple model where we assume that this random potential is spatially uncorrelated, okay? Which is not quite a correct assumption, but it can be accounted for and doesn't qualitatively change the result. So then you have to solve a simple problem in probability theory. If you have n independently distributed random variables, what's the minimum value of these n random variables? It's a nice exercise in basic probability theory. And anyway, so when you solve that problem, you can show the minimum value scales like this quantity. It goes like log L times square root sigma times these elastic constants. So that's the optimal potential energy gain of an isolated dislocation. Now in our problem, sigma Unlike the original random phase shift model, the sigma itself is running logarithmically. And so then we get this optimal energy cost going like log L to 3/2, which is the result of Zeng, Leith, and Fisher from their numerics. And this gives a, you know, these arguments give a simple understanding of this result. So let's apply this to the problem at hand. So the double dislocation, the elastic energy cost is this guy. This, for the single dislocation, it's this, this is the elastic energy cost. Now, the optimal potential energy of a vortex doesn't depend on Ks, it only depends on Kc, and you end up with this answer for both dislocations, but with a different value of m. M is 1 in this case, and m is 2 here. So you see that the balance between elastic energies and vortex potential energies depends on stiffness. Right? So the physics of the problem is then determined by which vortex proliferates first. Okay? So as you increase the length scale beyond the Larkin length, one vortex will take over. And whichever vortex takes over, then this running of these, the sigma gets cut off beyond that length scale. And beyond that length scale, it just becomes a problem where everything decays exponentially. Okay? So that then will further change the balance between elastic and potential energy gains. So now we can address this question of whether single dislocations are necessarily introduced. So let's suppress single dislocations by hand and then examine the stability of the resulting state to reintroducing them. Right? So in the presence of this long-range spin pneumatic order, the elastic energy of the single dislocation is proportional to log L. But once I have a fully disordered CDW state, disordered by double dislocations, this running of sigma is stopped, and the random energy gain now just becomes a constant. Right? This vortices are screened by the double vortices, and then there's nothing, the energy gain in the random potential, instead of it being log L to 3/2, just becomes a constant. This means that single dislocations are no longer favored, and one gets the spin density wave blast state coexisting with the spin pneumatic long range order. Okay? So, unlike in the CDW problem, here, depending on parameters, you can end up with the situation where single dislocations are not introduced. Okay? So, that's the justification for this phase diagram. I think I've already said everything here. So to verify some of these things, you know, this is all very, very delicate stuff in two dimensions. So to verify this, we did some numerics on a simple model of two coupled XY orders, one for the CDW and one for the spin density wave or pair density wave. And you know, when writing down the model, you had to make sure that everything is gauge invariant. And indeed, this model is. And you turn on some random field. And it's a classical model, so it can be studied by Monte Carlo simulations. But it's a classical problem with disorder, so equilibration becomes an issue if you go to very low temperature. So we didn't go to very low temperature and tried to look to see if this pneumatic order persists over long length scales. The answer is indeed yes, actually surprisingly robust. So this data taken when the ratio of these two stiffnesses is very, very small, so it should have favored single dislocations. But even then, so what you see is that, so shown in blue are the CDW correlations and red are the pneumatic correlations. So the CDW correlations, as you decrease the temperature, they increase a little bit, but the pneumatic correlations, they persist out to much longer length scales. Because it's finite temperature, everything eventually will decay, but the, you know, it clearly persists, has much more stability than than the CDW correlations. To emphasize this point, we can plot the correlation length of the CDW as a function of temperature. So this is decreasing temperature, and it increases as you decrease temperature and saturates at some value. And you can also do the same for the pneumatic correlation. And the pneumatic correlation at high temperature they're more short-ranged than the CDW correlators. But as you decrease the temperature, it takes over, and this correlation length is bigger than this guy. Right? So and this seems to happen even when this ratio of stiffness is as low as 0.2.
This model allows for this location.
Yeah.
Can you go back? I just got a little lost. So why does it have order of the cosine? I would have thought it'd be the physical order parameter is theta n plus theta s. Right?
Yeah.
So why isn't it cosine of sum of the two rather than product of the cosine?
You could also write that model. Okay. There's just some model. Just chose one model to study.
This has a, this also has a term which is cosine of that theta n minus theta.
That's right, yeah.
Does that make sense?
It's allowed.
Right.
Yeah.
And you probably said this, can you remind me again what causes sigma to flow? That was in a vortex free model.
Right.
If you take this theory, you make it vortex free.
Sigma will flow.
Sigma is a variance of H.
No. So the variance of H is in that notation, it was G. So G is the variance of the random field. Sigma is this force correlator. It's this, there's a term that's, if you expand this out, there's a term that's linear in the gradients that's induced by the disorder. Right? In two dimensions, that term is marginal, and you have to keep it. The microscopic model doesn't, but it'll be generated once you...
So why didn't you put it in by hand?
We could have, but we just chose a simple model. That's wide variety of things that...
So sigma is a variance of eta.
Sigma is a variance of eta, that's right, yeah. And, because of this RG flow, wherever it went, sigma is running off to infinity. But it doesn't feed back into anything else because of a statistical symmetry associated with shifting the phase. Anyway, so the numeric seems to confirm this story that this pneumatic correlator is very, very robust and persists even in the presence of strong disorder. Okay, so in terms of applications of the 2D story, already talked about this, the implication for the PDW. Now, in the spin density wave context, the cuprate phase diagram is well known to have this spin glass phase at low doping. And it's also well known through neutron diffraction that it has substantial spin stripe correlations. People don't really know what this phase is. Right? So it's at least conceivable that it's a 2D spin density wave glass phase with long range spin pneumatic order. And at finite temperature, yeah. But at zero temperature, it'll just be there.
I thought the vortices always appear.
No. So in 2D,
spin vortices need not appear.
That's right, yeah. Spin vortices need not appear. So you could be here. So 2D, there are two phases. Yeah, so that was the argument, right? So it goes as L to the 3 half so long as in the vortex free model.
Yes.
But once double dislocations proliferate, that L to the log L to the 3 halves is killed. And so it's very delicate, right?
Yes.
So the numerics gives us some confidence boost that it's okay.
You don't think the numeric correlation goes to infinity?
It's a finite temperature anyway. If we had the help of serious people like Roger, we could do anything we wanted, zero temperature, whatever. But, I don't know how to program anything, and David has had to learn. I think we'll wash our hands off this at this stage and let the professional numerists take over. Actually, there are really good algorithms to do zero temperature calculations, I'm told. Certainly beyond the expertise of, certainly beyond my expertise. All right, so let me summarize. So hopefully, you know, I've convinced you that the problem I've discussed is very, very generic. In fact, the surprising thing to me is that this problem was not discussed before. It's such a basic question about spin density waves that I thought it would have been answered in the 1990s. So in 3D, and maybe also depending on parameters in 2D, the spin nematic order survives in a weakly disordered spin density wave, and you end up with this uniaxial spin glass in a Heisenberg spin system. Yeah.
So in 3D, for example, you break smooth density two transitions here, two symmetries, break the nematic, you break the nematic symmetry and the spin order internally, that symmetry, or like what's the order parameter that develops the critical tension here?
Oh, it's the spin quadrupole moment. There's two order parameters. There's an Edwards-Anderson order parameter. They could be, but if it's driven by the, you know, if this is the ordering that sets in, then both transitions will occur at the same temperature. It's conceivable that there can be a phase which has spin nematic order without the spin glass order. Right? But it doesn't need to be the case. They can both happen at the same time. Right? Anytime you have two coupled order parameters, that's the story. Right? The transition can either happen as one direct transition or split into two transitions. No, actually, this kind of pneumatic order, since it's driven by this spin glass type ordering, that's not necessarily a first order transition. If you had pure pneumatic without any spin glass, then Landau theory would tell you that's a first order transition because it's a cubic invariant. But anyway, I'm only talking about zero temperature state. The entire question of phase transitions out of this black glass, as you know very well, is I think totally not addressed. Just understanding the phase itself is hard enough. So I think I want to emphasize this may be an interesting experimental opportunity to probe this black glass physics. This black glass stuff sounds important and cool and fundamental. There's very few probes of it in experiments, you know, other than in vortex matter. So maybe just studying spin density waves is a good way to learn about black glass. Then the spare density wave, I think it's definitely worthwhile for somebody to go and look at LBCO with a scanning squid and see whether you get any signature of broken time reversal or not. All right, let me stop there. Yes, I overran, sorry. On the spin glass, you mean the? Yeah. Oh, the caption is this is the wave vector, and this is the intensity. This is elastic neutron scattering of copper manganese at, and I believe this data is at 1.3% manganese, and this at 0.55% manganese. Oh, the top right is how this incommensurate order, how the delta associated with this incommensurate peak changes as a function of manganese concentration. And this inset, actually it's very, very interesting that the location of this wave vector correlates very well with 2KF wave vectors in copper. So really the picture for copper manganese indeed seems to be that you have Friedel oscillations around manganese atoms which lock together, which are frozen by the manganese, and they're induced in the copper substrate, and they lock into some configuration. And so that's the picture of the spin glass in the classic spin glass.
Here, the manganese is not believed to have a moment, so it's not really a
angle. Anderson model. You know. But that, no, I just wanted to emphasize that this is maybe better thought of as a spin density wave glass, perhaps not with spin pneumatic order or even black glass order, but But the short scale picture is a spin density wave.
Sure.
Rather than the more conventional OKKY spin glass picture.
So in the phase diagram you were showing and talking about what happens maybe in two dimensions.
Yeah.
And so remember the one which has like red and blue on the
octuplet. Which way does it go?
So
yeah, I stole this off the internet.
So what's the order parameter there in that?
In this region?
Right.
So experimentally, it's not known, right? So one of the possibilities that I'm suggesting is that it's a 2D spin density wave glass with long range spin pneumatic order. Right? So there are other ideas that people have proposed that it may be spiral magnetism.
So what happens to the nonlinear susceptibility?
Oh, the nonlinear susceptibility will, you know, at the phase transition, it will diverge.
In that phase,
yeah. It will diverge in that phase diagram. I believe it. Actually, I don't know whether what happens in the Cupid experiments.
It does. I think at least yeah. In the quantum dope 214.
Uh-huh.
But I guess my question is about the model.
Oh, yeah, I think it will. I don't see why it won't. Because this, it has long range spin pneumatic order, but otherwise, it's just a spin glass. But of course, it's a 3D, you know, it has to be stabilized by 3D. To get the finite temperature ordering, you need the 3D. No, the stripe order is an experimentally observed thing. Here, so if you do neutron experiments in the spin glass regime, you definitely see spin density wave. Short-range spin density wave peaks. Right? Now, but it's also a spin glass. So the question is, what's actually going on? Right? And I don't know that this is what's going on, but I'm saying that this is a possible candidate. Sorry? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The people are doing experiments right now as we speak in YBCO trying to get a better handle on what's going on in that region. So experimentalists, I think, will clarify very quickly. But it's not central to the rest of the cuprates, but it's sort of curious for its own sake.